Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. Today is Election Day, and we will examine some of the issues voters are being asked to vote on. It has been labeled Fresno's poorest neighborhood, the latest effort to transform the area known as Lowell Jefferson, plus turning young people on to jazz. But first, it is Election Day, and locally voters are going to the polls to elect city council members, supervisors, members of the Assembly, and Congress. But more and more, the party affiliation of candidates may not matter. A new poll recently released by the Pew Research Center says many of us are choosing to mark independent next to party affiliation. The poll showed 38% of adult voters call themselves independent. 32% say they are Democrats, and 24% call themselves Republicans. Something to think about as we vote today. With today's California primary, some voters are getting messages that might make them think twice. In some races, unions are urging Democrats to vote for Republicans. In others, business groups are urging Republicans to vote for Democrats. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on a change in political strategy inspired by California's new top two primary.
The huge words on the mailer jump off the page. Republicans, it tells voters in an Orange County Assembly district, the only Republican candidate for state assembly has dropped out of the race. Don't waste your vote on a Republican who is not running. The mailer then goes on to wholeheartedly endorse one of the Democratic candidates, whom it describes as anti-tax, pro-business, and tough on crime. Then there's this radio ad airing in parts of the Central Valley.
He put himself through college, and he's been serving the community ever since, leading efforts to protect farmers from excessive taxes and safeguard homeowners from loan fraud.
Protecting farmers from excessive taxes, a campaign ad you'd think would be for a Republican, but it's for a Democrat.
Adam Gray, Central Valley Values for State Assembly. Paid for by Jobs PAC, a bipartisan coalition of California employers.
Both ads are paid for by Jobs PAC, a political action committee led by the California Chamber of Commerce. They represent a new strategy in the state's changed political climate. Longtime GOP strategist Marty Wilson is running the chamber's effort. He says the new combination of the top two primary and independently drawn legislative districts have created far more competitive races, particularly for state assembly. So
there's a lot of opportunity for us to go in and look at the top two primary process and see if there's a means by which we can get Democrats to vote for Republicans or Republicans to vote for Democrats.
Before this year, that was never possible in a primary. But now, under the top two system, a voter of any party or a registered independent can vote for a candidate in any party. Wilson says the goal is to find more pragmatic candidates. Others might use the word moderate.
We're looking for somebody that has the attitude that, you know, they're going to be here to solve problems and not climb up on some ideological soapbox and proclaim their views to the world, which is really not very productive.
The chamber isn't alone in adapting to the new system. The Service Employees International Union, which declined an opportunity to comment on this story, is spending big to convince some Democrats to vote for Republicans. Take, for example, an assembly race along the Orange County coastline. GOP Assemblyman Alan Mansour faces a challenge from another Republican. Mansour has signed a no-tax pledge. His challenger has not. Mansour says he's been the target of hit pieces.
There's been a variety of pieces. I mean, you have independent expenditure committees sending out a ton of mail in support of my opponent and attacking me.
Like this one that says during the state budget crisis, Alan Mansour gave his Capitol staff a raise. That mailer comes from a group of health professionals and unions called Californians for Fiscal Accountability. Tea Party Assemblyman Tim Donnelly, who also faces a GOP challenger, says he's been the target of similar mailers.
When you can bring forces like that, you can literally sway an election. And the people in my district like me. The unions hate my guts, so they've sent eight mail pieces. Eight mail pieces.
But the June primary may be just a taste of things to come. Alan Hoffenblum, who handicaps political races for a publication called the California Target Book, says many interest groups are waiting until the general election to spend most of their money.
Now, all they have to do is be in the top two, and they better have the money ready to be able to be competitive in the election of consequence.
Hoffenblum says as many as 23 assembly races and 4 state Senate runoffs could feature 2 candidates from the same party. Democrats are currently 2 votes shy in each House of the 2/3 supermajority needed to raise taxes or send initiatives to voters. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
In San Jose, voters are being asked to weigh in on plans to dramatically change pension programs in those cities. In San Jose, where pension expenses this year will make up around 1/4 of the city's general fund, Measure B would require new employees to pay half the cost of their pensions and existing employees 1/3. In San Diego, where around 20% of the general fund goes to cover pension liabilities, voters will have to decide whether to replace their current pension system with a 401k-type program for all new city employees except police officers. Cities across California are closely following the vote as they seek solutions for their own budget problems. Between 1999 and 2010, pension spending among California cities and counties grew at a pace of 11% per year. And according to a new study from Stanford University, the state's 24 municipal pension systems are underfunded by a combined $135 billion. What does this mean for cities and counties in the Valley? And what about the employees who rely on the promise of a public pension in retirement? The answer largely depends on where you look and who you talk to. FM 89's Joe Moore has this report.
When you look up the origins of the word pension in the dictionary, you'll see it comes from the Latin verb pendo, which means to pay or value, or to weigh or hang. It's actually the same root that gives us nouns like pendant. And back here in the 21st century, that second meaning might be appropriate, as the costs of providing a defined benefit program are increasingly weighing down budgets across the state. According to some estimates, California's 3 largest statewide pension systems, CalPERS, CalSTRS, and the UC Retirement System, could have a combined shortfall of as much as $500 billion. That's billion with a B. And a new study from Stanford University paints an equally grim picture at the local level. According to its author, public policy professor and former Democrat State Assemblymember Joe Nation, California's city and county pension systems are on the verge of their own crisis, with $135 billion in total unfunded liabilities. Nation's study looked at California's 24 largest municipal pension systems, from the city of Los Angeles and San Jose to Kern County and the city of Fresno. And he says while some pension systems are doing better than others,
there's really no one that I know in California that's in good shape. And it's because every single one of them made these overly optimistic assumptions about how much they would earn.
And as Fresno City Council member Lee Brand says, when it comes to pensions, assumptions can be especially problematic.
As you get involved in the pension realm, you know, it's what's the old saying, there's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. It certainly applies here.
So what exactly happened? Don't fund managers account for the ups and downs of the market? Nation says the problem actually started long before the recent recession.
This really has been brewing for quite some time. Every pension system in California and across the country made assumptions about investment rates of return that were simply not realistic. Most of them assumed that they would earn about 8% per year. That's on their portfolio overall. And because they are typically invested in both fixed income instruments and also in others, and you know, in stock market and so forth, to get to that number, you need to earn about 11% per year in the stock market. And most people would laugh at the notion that you can earn 11% per year in the stock market. It's just not a realistic number.
But what exactly is a realistic number? The truth is, it depends who you ask. Federal law requires that private pension funds tie their anticipated rates of return to the interest rate on corporate bonds. That's around 5%. But public pension funds don't have to follow that law, and their discount rates are typically between 7.5% and 8%.
If you're off just 0.25%, just 0.25% on your assumption, and so instead of 8%, we average over the next 10 years or 20 years, 7.75%, that has big implications. It'll cost the city a lot more money, or the employees a lot more money.
Nation's study, which was co-released by the nonpartisan Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research and the group California Common Sense, applies an assumption of a 5% return, which it terms no risk. And the difference between that 5% and 8% is huge, especially for the city of Fresno. Last fall, the city hired a firm to analyze the status of various internal funds to see if any extra money happened to be lying around, including pensions. And for once, the news was actually good.
The city of Fresno, unlike many cities, and you probably all know this, is in a unique position in being overfunded. And while many pension funds are struggling and having problems, the city of Fresno's employee retirement system as of June 30th, 2010 was funded at about 122% of need, and the police and fire about 110%.
That was consultant Craig Rousseau of the firm Harvey M. Rose Associates speaking to the city council in March 2012. The council was exploring the possibility of using some of the extra money in the pension fund to pay for retiree health care, which, unlike many cities, isn't covered by the pension system in Fresno. While the move would save the city money in the general fund, it would also require the approval of the city's independent pension board. But when Joe Nation studied Fresno, his results weren't as good. Using his more conservative 5% return, Fresno's pension system was only 77% funded, short of the 80% that is generally considered the minimum. Still, Councilmember Lee Brand says the system is one of the few bright spots in the city's finances.
Our retirement system is pretty stable, very fair, and if anything, on a comparative basis, city employees, including public safety, actually get less than their counterparts in Oakland, San Jose, Long Beach, Stockton, etc. And that's, as I said to begin with, that's the bright spot we have.
In fact, according to Nation's study of the 24 largest municipal pension systems in the state, the city of Fresno's system ranked first. Its 77% funded ratio put it significantly ahead of both Fresno County, which is only 49% funded, and Kern County, which again, using a 5% rate of return, is only 41% funded, the worst in the state. Under the higher discount rate favored by the counties, the numbers aren't much better. Fresno County is 73% funded, and Kern County is just 63% funded. So what are some of the possible solutions? Aside from a major increase in the stock market? Nation says any action on the issue will probably come from the local level and not from Sacramento.
At some point, you might have this sort of a bottom-up approach or a bottom-up solution where folks at the local level are the ones who solve this, not our, quote, state leaders, who for the most part are disinterested in this.
But making changes to benefits promised to current employees and those who have already retired is highly controversial, and for good reason. In many cases, labor groups made concessions in pay and other compensation in return for the security of a government pension down the road. Regina Kane, president of the Service Employees International Union 521 in Kern County, says part of the problem is poor management during good times.
6 or so years ago, Kern County did not participate in allocating money into the pension fund when the years were good, nor did they give employees a raise.
She says that too often, public employees are being blamed for problems that are a lot bigger than defined benefit retirement programs.
Private employees obviously were suffering, but because one group of people were suffering doesn't mean that we should then limit public employees from having a pension.
But even Kane admits that some reforms are perhaps necessary. She says there's a difference between pensions paid to public safety workers and her members.
when you have a particular retirement package that says, you know, 3% at 50 versus someone who's a caregiver who makes a lower salary whose retirement is based on 3% at 60, there's a huge disparity. The safety persons whose salary is higher in the first place have many more years to enjoy their retirement. And so possibly some reforms of all retirements, you know, should be looked at, as well as ways that we can all work together to improve the whole economy by increasing jobs in a lot of areas to bring in more revenue.
Voters in San Diego and San Jose will decide today what path they wish to take towards changing their defined benefit pension plans. And if attempts in those cities are successful, other cities and counties will likely follow suit. But despite the controversy, Joe Nation says it's time that cities and counties address what at least he sees as a significant problem.
And so until you get people to recognize that there is a tremendous problem, you're not going to be able to get people to sit down and to work it out.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
When voters go to the polls today, they will also decide measures on term limits and a cigarette tax. But they won't be voting on anything that would deal with the state's chronic budget woes. That won't happen until November. California's deficit has nearly doubled since the start of the year, and it is now nearly $16 billion. Again, Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on how the deficit grew so big.
The biggest reason for the deficit surge is the state planned on a whole bunch of money it didn't get. Now, you might think there's a pretty simple explanation for that.
It's the economy, stupid.
It's the economy, stupid.
It's the economy, stupid.
But actually, just about everyone agrees it's not. First of all, taxes on capital gains and corporations came in well short of projections. Here's how Democratic Governor Jerry Brown explained things a couple of weeks ago.
The capitalist system is not coincident with your expectations of exactitude. It doesn't play like we may want it to.
But the governor and legislative Democrats did project an extra $4 billion in revenue in last year's budget. From the start, Republicans called it wishful thinking. Senate Minority Leader Bob Huff.
There were unrealistic assumptions made last year. Obviously, the most notable was the $4 billion that magically appeared when they were that far apart from closing the budget.
Beyond the revenue, there were other problems. Federal judges and the Obama administration rejected some Health and Human Services cuts, and it turns out schools are owed more than originally thought, thanks to the state's incredibly complex education funding formula. Here's Governor Brown.
The budget has hundreds of funds. We have lots of restraints and rules, and figuring out is not just showing up and saying, okay, we got a $8 billion gap, let's start cutting like someone in business. It's a pretzel palace of incredible complexity.
A palace that now has a gaping hole ripped right through it. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Well, the Fresno County Sheriff's Department has long suffered from budget woes, but for the first time in 2.5 years, the second floor of the Fresno County Jail may soon be occupied. It's all part of the statewide realignment of inmates from prisons to county jails. FM 89's Ezra Romero has this report.
Since 2010, the second and third floors of the Fresno County Jail in downtown Fresno have been empty. Budget cuts resulted in the layoffs of around 70 officers who worked in the jail, forcing Sheriff Margaret Mims to close the floors and begin the early release of prisoners.
Right now, our capacity is right about 2,300 inmates, and we run at 100% capacity almost all of the time.
That was Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. But just as Fresno County has struggled to deal with the cost of keeping inmates behind bars, the state of California has faced the same issue. In Sacramento, the solution was Assembly Bill 109, otherwise known as realignment, a program which has resulted in the transfer of low-risk offenders from state prisons to county jails. And now, funding from the state's realignment program may result in the reopening of another floor of the county's jail.
That will give us a little bit more room to hold inmates And, in fact, it will also help decrease our releases, which is an important issue for a lot of people.
Last October, Fresno County began receiving inmates from state prisons as part of AB 109 and received funds to reopen the first floor of the jail, which had also been closed. Since then, the first floor of the jail has run out of beds, forcing Sheriff Margaret Mims to daily release dozens of low-level offenders and the occasional AB 109 criminal.
It just happened so fast, and we got the inmates so fast. I mean, we expected 506 over a nine-month period, and we reached that number in a three-month period. So it just hit us so hard, so fast. We were just scrambling all the time to try and adjust for it.
In response to the bulging numbers in the jail and probation system, the seven-member Community Corrections Partnership, created in June of 2011 in anticipation of AB 109 legislation to oversee public safety funds, has taken action. The group, including Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims, Chief Probation Officer Linda Penner, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer, and others, voted last Friday in a public meeting at the Fresno Hall of Records in favor of Mims' plan to open the second floor. The decision to award the department $11 million came after the idea was tabled earlier this month by the CCP due to jail costs and the use of a possible facility in Kalinga. The change of opinion came after a county report showing a decision to house inmates at the Kalinga facility would cost a lot more than the sheriff's plan.
We're back on track. This was the plan last year in August. It continues to be a good plan. I am encouraged that we are going to have additional money in reserve for additional programs as we see fit.
Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer said he supports the decision, although he still has concerns over who has control over releases. The county currently holds over 1,500 additional inmates because of realignment.
I'm very confident in the decision today to open the second floor of the jail in light of the fact that there's an additional $3.1 million that will allow us to explore other alternatives to custody. We are in desperate need of additional beds at the jail, and that's what we did today. We bought ourselves some time.
During the meeting, several members of the public argued that simply locking criminals behind bars is not enough, saying that without a better rehabilitation system, criminals will reoffend. County Supervisor Susan Anderson agrees with the public.
I don't disagree that we do need more beds because we have to hold people accountable, but I would like to see this committee also be as interested in expanding the treatment programs as they are in opening more floors to the jail and creating more beds.
Despite complaints from the public, the panel agreed on a $20.8 million plan for the next fiscal year, leaving around $2 million for alternatives to incarceration. Most of the funds are slated for the Sheriff's Department, and $4.3 million is budgeted for the Probation Department. The rest of the funds are allotted for the District Attorney's Office, other law enforcement, and county health departments. Mims said she has hope for the future because her request was accepted, but she said she knows that any plans made today could disappear in the state budget process.
I'm encouraged that at least this time of year I'm not looking for a place to find to cut several million dollars, because that's historically is where we've been. So as we start planning on how we ramp up, one of my priorities will be to open up the last floor in the jail, and that's what I'll be asking the board to do.
Mims said if plans go as scheduled, the second floor will open sometime in July, pending approval by county supervisors and funding in the next state budget. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra Romero.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. We will be back in just a moment.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, it is the poorest neighborhood in the city of Fresno, with the poverty rate at 54%. The Lowell Jefferson neighborhood, it is defined as the triangle created by Highway 180, Divisadero Street, and Blackstone Avenue. It sits in the shadow of downtown Fresno, a neighborhood struggling not only with poverty, but crime. There is a huge effort to transform the neighborhood, starting with the families who live in the area. They form the Lowell Neighborhood Association and meet monthly working to empower the residents and maintain a constant dialogue with government and other agencies. One of the efforts centers around rebuilding the neighborhood, which has a lot of poor housing conditions. Here to talk about this latest effort is Tamara Glover, Program Director of the Housing Reconstruction Training Program at Fresno City College, Dr. Don Simmons, Vice Chair of the Lowell Community Development Corporation, and Mr. Simmons also lives in the neighborhood, and H. Steele, a student who is working in the program. Thank you all for joining us today to talk about this important issue. Let's start by talking about the Fresno City College Housing Reconstruction Program. Seems like a great program because you're not only building a home, but you're also teaching skills.
Correct. We have a six-month training program through Fresno City College in which we combine reconstruction and new construction skills theory and lab in the first 12 weeks. And the second 12 weeks of the training we spend out at a job site, out at a house, with our partnerships through the Housing Authority or the Redevelopment Agency, where the students get hands-on experience remodeling a home.
Do any of these students live in the neighborhood as well?
We've had a few students who have joined the program through from the neighborhood, yes.
And H, you participated in the program.
Yeah, I did. We graduated a week or two ago, and I was there for the whole 6 months. It was a fantastic experience.
Had you built anything before?
I had just gotten into construction a few months before the program started, but I abandoned my job that I had at the time to learn more quickly aspects about construction.
And how do you think – what kind of skills did you gain?
We learned everything from the ground up, basically. So roofing, foundations, electric, plumbing, everything.
Now, is construction something that you want to do, or was this more of an effort to kind of give back to the community?
Well, it was a little of both. I had my hand in some projects in the Lowell neighborhood already, but I was also interested in construction, so this was just the perfect opportunity for me.
Now, this program, Tamara, how does it work? When is it? If somebody's interested, what do they do?
We are actually starting our third cohort or third group of students this Friday. So the last opportunity to join would be to show up on Wednesday at 3 o'clock at Fresno City College, the T110 building. And we give a presentation about what the program entails, what the requirements are, what the benefits are, and encourage people to join the program.
Now, Dr. Simmons, you are part of the Community Development Corporation,
right?
Correct? And
yes.
You also live in the Lowell neighborhood, and I assume that is by choice for you.
That's by choice, absolutely. I was fortunate enough to be able to buy a 1902 four-square historic home in the neighborhood and worked in restoring that and rehabbing that and live in that home. You may know that Lowell has about 40% of our housing stock was built before 1920.
They have a lot of historic homes in that
neighborhood. A lot of historic. I also am the vice chair of the city's Historic Preservation Commission. So it's the right place to be if you're interested in historic homes. But I've lived there. We formed the Lowell Community Development Corporation because we knew that home ownership would make such a difference in people's lives. And many of the people in our neighborhood could never move to the point of home ownership because of financial setbacks and employment and some other issues. But we said that the CDC could help people do that. So far, we've been able to help two families move into homes that they own. The CDC has purchased an empty lot, a blighted lot on Calaveras, where we've hired an architect, worked with neighbors to help design the kind of home that we want in our neighborhood. And so we are in the process now of beginning to build our home in our neighborhood and work with groups like Tomorrow's Group at Fresno City College, the Housing Authority, and local developers to say this is what we want Lowell to be like, homeowners living in the neighborhood, so that when people hear about Lowell, they don't think about poverty and crime. They think about a proud, happy community that's working together to make some changes.
And also, when people are when people own their home, number one, You don't have to deal with that transient neighborhood. So when you get to know people, they take more pride in their neighborhood, and it's easier to start bringing about the kind of change you want to affect in a neighborhood.
Absolutely. You can almost tell the difference between who's a homeowner and who is a person who's not going to be there very long by how they take care of their yard, how often they paint, if repairs are made on the home, and then in their interactions with the neighbors, because they make an investment of their time in order to get the people who live around them. Homeownership has been found in some neighborhoods to bring down crime because people are watching out for what they own. They will be more vigilant when it's their ownership on the line, and they make certain precautions and do some things like forming associations and a strong neighborhood watch in the places where they own rather than just rent.
And if I'm not mistaken, in the Lowell Jefferson neighborhood where this transformation is going on, you have a lot of historic homes, but there was a time, I mean, there was a lot of poor housing conditions as well. And by doing what you're doing, you're slowly trying to change that.
Right. Lowell has been the victim of some really bad planning. and so Lowell didn't get there overnight in the way that it is, where people came in and literally plowed down and demolished beautiful historic homes and put up apartments so they could squeeze a lot of people into a small space. And so it's those multifamily units that sprung up, little shoeboxes that aren't very well built, definitely aren't very well insulated, and people pack into those, and that's usually where we find the problems in our neighborhood. And so we're trying to kind of reverse that trend and turn that around.
You know, H, you also mentioned that you live in the neighborhood as well.
Well, I'll be moving there in a month or two. I'm currently working with a real estate investor and remodeling some homes on a couple of the streets. So right now we're working on a small studio, and when we finish that, I'll be moving in.
And for you, what is the attraction to the neighborhood, or is this for you being part of the effort to really try to revitalize and change your neighborhood?
Well, I like being part of the effort, and I have found that the neighbors in the area are fantastic, and they're very involved, and they give tons of effort into rebuilding the community.
Why do you, Dr. Simmons, because you have made the commitment to live there, think it's important that when you have a neighborhood like Lowell, because we have a lot of neighborhoods in Fresno that need improving, but for people like yourself to move in and help kind of diversify the neighborhood?
Well, diversity is one of our strengths in Lowell. Our neighbors don't all look alike. We are not from the same socioeconomic class. We're not of the same faith. Many things are different about Lowell, and so understanding how to live together comfortably and really enjoy it makes a huge difference, but also because of our proximity to downtown, and I believe our proximity to City Hall, it makes a difference that we're a healthy and a safe neighborhood. You know, when downtown starts to move in a positive direction, if one day high-speed rail station comes in, we're the closest neighborhood. You know, I would be a five-minute walk from the station where I live now. I can walk to City Hall. I can walk to Fulton Mall. For us, it's a walkable neighborhood. With the advent of our new Lowell Community Garden, you see almost every plot is full. My basil is high. my neighbor's tomatoes are already there. But because we've borrowed a phrase in Lowell that says when when downtown sneezes, Lowell gets pneumonia. So any downtown problems really affect us. Anything when jail overcrowding happens, when those things happen in the city, it impacts Lowell. And the statistic may be that we're really not the highest crime neighborhood any longer. That's turning around. We may not.
I think so. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I think that is the case.
Yes.
I know that you were moving in that direction.
We're moving
away from
in that,
that
direction.
And that because there is a huge effort. It's
absolutely.
Like Lowell Jefferson is like the Petri dish. And if we can, I think the feeling is if we can affect change there, then we can spread it to other neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
Tomorrow?
I've seen a huge, amazing transformation just for when I've started the program. In 2009, when I would drive the streets in the neighborhood of Lowell, the improvements that have happened over time by the pure attention and details that are happening throughout the community and specifically house by house. The houses that have been remodeled through the efforts of the Redevelopment Agency, the NSP program, the Housing Authority, the neighbors next to them, I could just see it. The beginning was just the trash wasn't there anymore. And then the yards became better taken care of. And now there's so many efforts. It's contagious, and it's contagious in a wonderful way that the house next door looks better, so I'm going to make my house look better. And you can see the difference in that transformation over the last 18 months, just that I've been involved. That's amazing.
And why do you think this is important? Because just from yourself, you've lived there for 10 years, and you've talked about how long this program is. When you go into an area to try to affect change, I think that it's understanding that this is not something that's going to happen overnight.
Absolutely.
And there has to be a long-term commitment.
Right.
There are neighbors that have been working on the transformation of Lowell for over 20 years. The group that's been there for a long time of people who relocated on purpose, who went in there to say, I can make a difference with my neighbors' lives. They've been at it for a long time. At 10 years, I'm a fairly newcomer to the process. But as more and more people come in, we realize there's still a lot of work to do. It's not going to happen overnight. But what happens is that Lowell kind of gets to you after a while.
Yeah,
you start to feel that there's something different about this neighborhood. And living in that close proximity with neighbors where you really get to know people that are not all the same as you, where you start to work together, you eat together, you start to go after things together. You know, we worked hard for many years to get a community garden. We worked hard for many years to build the playground that's under the freeway over ramps at Poplar and Belmont. Some of those things we've worked hard for, and we're continuing to work together.
There's a sense of connection in the Lowell neighborhood, and it's a connection between the residents. It's a connection between the city, between individual investors, contractors, agencies. There's when you become part of that connection, it's just really a wonderful, wonderful thing. And as you said, there's lots of neighborhoods that need attention. But I really like personally this approach to focusing on it, making it happen over a long period of time, but with a concerted effort from connecting all of these players together.
And like you've mentioned, you've had different people who have come in organizations. Lowell Jefferson has a lot of support from City Hall and the mayor, as well as trying to help transform the neighborhood. You also have people from the Fresno Urban Ministry Project. And what kind of difference does that make when you place people in the neighborhood and they live there and they become part of the community?
It's no longer a drive-in problem. it's your neighborhood. It's your house. You start to care about your next-door neighbors in a way that you can't do if you just I call them drive-in to do service. You know, lots of people come to Lowell to help. But when you actually move in and you live there, you make a real statement to people that this is where I'm going to commit my time and my resources, my life. It's going to be here. I think by people deciding to move into Lowell instead of just come in and help periodically, it really starts to say, I trust that change is going to happen here and I can be a part of it.
It's a challenge at first, but with all the moving pieces always working together, I mean, there's the most community in the community I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
But like you mentioned, you talked about the challenge. I mean, when you first move there, you have to come out of your comfort zone, don't you?
Absolutely. But it's, you know, as we're starting to see,
you get a new comfort, right?
You get a new comfort, and you find a new way of understanding what is normal, and you start to be. Yeah, you know, I admit I'm a little defensive about my neighborhood. When I hear statistics, I want to check into them a little deeper and say,
I'm the same way.
Is it really less safe in Lowell than it is?
But you
in
know
some
what? I think of what it is as well is when you look at the statistics, and you know, coming from you know maybe one of the last reports, I don't know how much what you all are doing have been reflected yet in those statistics because you have a sustained ongoing effort in that neighborhood.
Could I just say that when we hear about the concentrated pockets of poverty, which most people I don't think really fully understand what that means, but then you look at a neighborhood like Lowell or the next door neighborhood of Jefferson and you see some concentrated pockets of organizations that are addressing those issues, that, you know, how many other neighborhoods have the EOC Sanctuary on one block, Community Medical Center on the next block, Salvation Army on the next block, Fresno Urban Development Corporation on the next block, over and over. And then the care homes that are there, because the boarding care homes came to Lowell first, and many of them are still there. So with our neighbors are not just people who are going to live in their homes, but some of them are being cared for. There are people with medical issues, psychological issues. Returning veterans are moving into a home in our neighborhood. And it's a neighborhood where it's not just single family homes, but a lot of other people with very specific needs. I say it's the neighborhood with the greatest level of concentrated compassion in all of Fresno because of what we have there. And that concentrated compassion is what's making the difference. It's safer. It feels healthier. It feels better in Lowell than it has in the past 10 years.
I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, I highly agree with all that. Yes.
And, you know, recently from what I've read, one of the big things about Lowell Jefferson there is an organization, Reading and Beyond. They've received a $500,000 grant to help develop a 10-year plan for the neighborhood. Now, are you all in I would assume, involved in that as well, since you are very involved residents in the neighborhood?
Absolutely. It's the program that I work with at Fresno State, the Humanics Program, is very much engaged with Reading and Beyond. Many of our students and interns are part of this program. And because when one activity happens in Lowell, like Reading and Beyond's program or Building Healthy Communities or any of those things, it engages all of us in a way. The Lowell Neighborhood Association gets very engaged in things. The Lowell CDC gets very engaged in things. And the other organizations that have been functioning in Lowell for a long time are a part of it. We may not be leading it, but we don't have to lead everything. We can be active, engaged participants.
And part of this huge effort really does, I notice, it centers around the schools. I mean, the schools there are like the meeting places for the residents. And when you get the residents on campus, they are parents. And then that helps that translates to them being involved in the school more.
Right. That's our school.
Yeah. Right.
The school is the center of our neighborhood. The mayor of the elementary school is our mayor in Lowell. There are other people who do work, but our work centers around making sure that our kids are safe and healthy, because that becomes the bellwether for how safe and healthy our neighborhood is. If the kids can ride their bikes to school, and many children at Lowell Elementary now ride their bikes to school, an extremely high percentage, over 70%.
One of the, as you were talking about Reading and Beyond's grant, one of the reasons that I feel we got the grant from HUD for this training program through Fresno City College is because of the concerted efforts and because of the connections and because of the collaboration. And I think that's really the key to making any of these activities or big transformations happen, is the connecting those entities, those funds, those people together. The other component that I feel is really important, and this is what we base all our training on, is the hands-on component. And there's something different. When I drive to our home that we remodeled, that's my home. That's our home. And even though I'm not going to live in it, I feel like I was a part of that because my hands touched that, versus I didn't write a check and mail it off. And there's something very real about the Lowell neighborhood and the hands-on and all of the programs that let our hands touch something important and positive and wonderful makes us buy in, I think, a little bit more.
Right.
Oh, that sounds great. What are you hoping will come? You know, the Reading and Beyond effort is just, you know, another piece of what you're doing. How do you think that can help the efforts that are already ongoing?
Reading and Beyond?
Yes.
I'm not very familiar with that.
Okay, as far as what they want to do. And it really kind of centers around education and that sort of thing. But you just think having another effort there, another group of people who are just as committed as you are.
Having another group of people who are committed, who are making a long-term investment because the Reading Beyond grant is a multi-year grant and they're going to be there for a while, that makes a big difference for us. But we want to also provide our residents in Lowell with as many resources as possible for their lives to be better. And Reading and Beyond's program, as well as others, is going to add to that menu of things. This can make life in Lowell a much more healthy, a better place to live. Your children are going to get a better education at Lowell. Those programs are just going to add to what's already happening.
And the key is, and Reading Beyond comes to events where we're talking about our collaborative efforts, and they're part of helping us to recruit for our training program at Fresno City College. And I really think, again, the key is the collaboration and connecting, and those resources connecting with each other makes the impact multiply. Because they're connecting all of the entities together.
They're all pieces to the puzzle.
Let's talk a little bit then about this next program that's coming up, your training program. If people want to get involved, what is the next step for them?
We have multiple options of getting involved. We have a mentorship program where we connect people in the construction field or the business field to our students. Our students specifically are over 18, read, write, and speak English, and they need to pass a reading assessment test to get in. But that's really the requirement. So they don't have to have a diploma. They don't have to have background in college education. This is a bridge program to expose people to college-level coursework in an environment that is safe and nurturing and has that hands-on component. So we are also looking for community involvement. We are looking to – we would love to sustain this program past the grant, which expires in 2013. So we are looking for many opportunities to keep this work going. And we're working with the Housing Authority and the City of Fresno to try to perpetuate this investment in a training mechanism as well as the investment in the training mechanism that remodels the homes. And we just feel that that's such a fantastic combination. We want to keep that going.
And you also have some informational meetings for people?
Right. So Wednesday will be our informational meeting tomorrow at 3 o'clock at Fresno City College, T100. You can get your information there. An informational meeting is where I spend about 45 minutes explaining the program, the requirements, the ideas, the benefits, and then the students can go through the application process right directly with me, and we can get them enrolled.
And the program is absolutely free, too, which is awesome.
So you finished up one, what they call cohort, one section.
Mm-hmm. I was with the second group. We just finished a couple weeks ago.
Are you going to participate in the next group?
Yeah. I'm working with trying to find a house for the third group right now. So there's some other pieces that need to be done, but it's starting next week, and I hope to have a hand in it.
When you say find a house, what you go, you're trying to find homes in the neighborhood that, you know, will benefit from this.
We want to continue to work on homes in Lowell, so.
And you don't have to look very far to find homes that need work. We're, because of the foreclosure crisis and other issues, we hit Lowell pretty hard. And so there are a lot of homes that are still ready. And between the City College program with Tamara and the Lowell CDC fund and other groups that are working in Lowell, houses are you hear hammers a lot now. Because people are working on homes and the partnerships are happening all over. You may not be in the cohort with the City College program, but we all seem to know someone who is in the cohort. And so we all become cheerleaders. And many of us attended the sort of graduation ceremony to support and to celebrate what was happening through this Fresno City College program. So all of us, we may not be actually building now, but we're supporters.
And this is a 6-month program, so this is a commitment on the part of the students.
Absolutely.
Who participate.
It is a full-time job in itself. It is free to the students. We provide them with the books, the tools, the supplies they need. They need to provide their clothing and their uniform. But we provide the tools they need. They need to provide the commitment and the time. The class is from 7:30 to 1:30, 5 days a week. So it's very intensive. We've taken a lot of information, a lot of college training, and packed it into 6 months. And we were focusing on people who were primarily unemployed so that they could spend their 6 months wisely and gain information that they can either use to get a job, or the beauty of this particular training that I love is you'll use it for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Because there's always work that needs to be done in your home, your mother's home, somebody's home, and it'll save you money over the time of your life. And it's not wasted training. So it's a great investment for anyone who has the time to spend this 6 months, because not only can it help you get a job, but it will be used for the rest of your life.
Sounds good. I'd like to thank all of you for coming in this morning. It's been a pleasure talking to you all. And the time went by so fast. Dr. Don Simmons, he's Vice Chair, Lowell Community Development Corporation. Tamara Glover, Program Director of the Housing Reconstruction Training Program at Fresno City College. And H. Steele, who participated in the program and is a resident of the community. Thank you all for joining us this morning. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Teaching young people about jazz. Joining me now is Jim Page with Jazz Fresno, here to talk about a new jazz education opportunities for kids. Thank you for coming in, Mr. Page. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Juanita.
First of all, tell me about the Milestones Youth Jazz Workshop.
Well, this is a project that we put together a few months ago to give kids who don't have opportunities to play jazz in their home school the opportunity to take part in jazz performance and education. We got some fabulous local jazz educators to jump on board.
Yeah, I saw the list. An impressive list of educators.
Yeah, we've got Larry Honda from Fresno City College, Mark Kasparian, who's built a fabulous middle school program at Tenaya Middle School, and then Ed Hull, who teaches at Fresno State, as well as Manchester Gate will be taking our beginning ensemble.
What do you think is important to teach jazz education?
Well, it's an American art form. And I think number one, that is so important that we continue to expose kids to it because we don't want that to be lost from our culture. Another really important thing is kids that are involved in jazz are typically really extraordinary students. The work that they put into this just really seems to spark something in their brains that really helps them aspire to bigger and better things. There's a lot of because it's based on improvisation, people think that they're just playing notes, but there's so much that they have to learn. Sounds funny to say you have to learn in order to improvise, but that's really the case. So I think it's really important to expose kids to this art for those reasons.
And, it is jazz, and you talk about it being really like an American art form, but it's also music. And everybody talks about how important music is when it comes to education.
That's true. That's very true. And, specific to jazz, it's such a social thing. If you've ever been around a group of kids who all play jazz, it's really an entertaining experience because it's this little culture that they all share. It's got its own language, but it's a great tool for kids who might be having if they're a little shy. It really helps them blossom, and it brings them out of their shells, and it gives them a tremendous amount of confidence.
Let's talk a little bit about the program itself. Now, it's my understanding you're going to have three different jazz ensembles.
Right, right. That our initial plan is that we'll have these three big band ensembles, which big band ensemble typically has between 15 and 20 people in it. We'll have one for kids who are playing at the beginning level, one at the intermediate level, and one at the advanced level. And I'm not talking about jazz skills, but just rather their playing abilities. Because you wouldn't need any jazz experience to be able to take part in this, because that's what these three great directors are for, to be able to teach these kids how to improvise and what this music is all about.
And so they don't need that experience to participate in
it. They don't need the jazz experience, right.
What about, you know, for the students, you know, instruments, cost, that sort of thing?
Right. There is a fee to participate in this. But what we've been really fortunate to be able to do is fundraise to the extent that we have a really large scholarship pool. And the primary concern of the donor who's helped us get this off the ground was he does not want, and we don't want, a child to not be able to participate because they can't afford it. So we have a really simple scholarship application. For families that can afford it, the tuition would be $75 a month for the 8-month school year. For families, if that was too much, it could be reduced all the way down to nothing. So we really want the desire and the need to drive this thing rather than, you know, I have the money, so I think I'll do this.
And so you say this is scheduled. When are you hoping to start? Because it sounds like you want this to go right along with the school year.
Right, right. We thought that was the best idea to run it as an after-school program. The ensembles will take place from 4 to 6 on different days of the week depending on the ensemble. And it'll start in September and it'll end at the end of April. We wanted to stay away from the first and last months of the school year because those are typically so busy for kids.
Yeah. And so now let's say if you have a parent or a young person who's interested in something like this or finding out more about it and might be wanting to participate, what do they need to do?
Well, we have a website for the project. Actually, there's a couple of ways you can get there. There's links to the milestone site from the Jazz Fresno site, so you could go to jazzfresno.org, or you could go directly to the milestone site, which is at milestonesjazz.org. You'll find more information on our directors there, information on tuition and scholarships. Where the registrations are open right now, our early registration period is open through June 15th. And any tweaks that we have to make to the program after that, we'll do when we find out how many kids we initially have registered.
Well, Jim, sounds like a really great program for young people. And then the opportunity for you just to say a little bit about Jazz Hop.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you haven't been down in the Tower District on the first Thursday of the month, you're really missing out. Jazz Hop is something that is kind of a takeoff on Art Hop. There's a bunch of different venues that have live jazz. There's everything from student groups to, you know, pros. We have a great jazz culture here. And it's almost like walking around in New Orleans, except you can't take your drink in a to-go cup when you leave the venue.
Okay. Well, it sounds like something else great to do this summer. Hey, thanks for coming in and talking about the program. It sounds like a great thing for young people. And appreciate Jazz Fresno for taking it on.
Thank you, Juanita.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joel Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.